We need to see whether they're cutting corners. We need to ask a lot of hard questions about their operations.
The oil and gas company Hilcorp is dealing with a potential third pipeline leak in Cook Inlet. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 7th. Good evening. I'm Rachel Waldholz. Also tonight, the Alaska congressional delegation reacts to U.S. missile strikes in Syria.
If he uses chemical weapons against his own people, he should expect the same or even a more devastating attack.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The federal agency charged with regulating pipelines is investigating another natural gas leak in Cook Inlet. This is the third report this year of equipment failure on infrastructure in the inlet owned by the oil and gas company Hilcorp, including another gas leak and an oil leak. As a result, the company started an audit of its pipelines in the region. According to spokesperson Lori Nelson, during an inspection, the company discovered that a pipeline on its Steelhead platform had more gas leaving the platform than what was arriving on shore. Nelson calls this a metering discrepancy, but she says the company took the line out of service on Saturday as a precaution. Several flights over the area didn't find any evidence of a gas leak. The line has been emptied of natural gas and filled with seawater since Monday. The state agencies involved in the other spills in Cook Inlet acknowledged they're aware of the situation on the Steelhead platform, but would not provide any other comments at this time. Lois Epstein is an engineer and the Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society. She joined calls from other environmental groups in Cook Inlet for an audit of Hilcorp's aging infrastructure.
They're very open about their business plan, which is to take over old fields and make them profitable for the company. We need to see whether they're cutting corners. We need to ask a lot of hard questions about their operations.
She says the company should not be allowed to expand its operations in Alaska without addressing concerns about its safety record. President Trump's decision to launch missiles on Syria Thursday night drew a range of reactions on Capitol Hill, but Alaska's all-Republican delegation to Congress gave it three thumbs up. Senator Dan Sullivan says the strike diminished Syria's chemical weapons capability and sends the Syrian president a message.
If he uses chemical weapons against his own people, he should expect the same or even a more devastating attack.
Sullivan is a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee and received a classified briefing today from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Senator Lisa Murkowski and Congressman Don Young also issued statements supporting the strike. Several critics of the missile attack, including Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, say it violates the Constitution because Trump did not seek authorization from Congress. That's not Sullivan's view.
I'll let the lawyers quibble about what that strike last night, whether that was, constitutionally a valid action. I'm supportive of it, and I think most members of Congress are supportive of it.
Several other senators said they don't know if the U.S. has a long-term strategy for Syria. As recently as last week, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said President Bashar al-Assad's future is up to the Syrian people. But this week, Tillerson said steps are underway for the international community to force Assad out. Sullivan says he doesn't know whether regime change is part of the Trump administration's strategy for Syria, and he declined to say whether he thinks it should be.
I think we have an opportunity to start reestablishing our leadership and reestablishing our credibility, but as I'm emphasizing, we have to do it with our allies and we have to do it carefully. We should not be out saying things that we intend to do or have as goals unless we are 100% committed to seeing them through.
Congress is now on a 2-week Easter recess. And it's official. The Army has decided to keep the 425 Brigade Combat Team intact at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. Today's announcement reverses a 2015 decision to substantially reduce the 5,000-soldier unit. The move comes as the Trump administration has pushed for increased military spending and higher troop levels, though local and congressional leaders have been working to stave off the cuts since they were first announced. Senator Dan Sullivan says the move shows the Pentagon recognizes the security challenges in the Arctic and Asia Pacific. Senator Lisa Murkowski issued a statement calling it a victory for the state and for national security. Praise also came from the governor's office and from Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz, whose administration set up a task force in 2015 to study the 425's economic impact. Along with the announcement came news that the Army will send 1,500 soldiers from the 425 to Afghanistan. John Pennell is a spokesperson for the Army in Alaska and says the timeline for the deployment is not yet finalized, but will happen in the second half of the year.
We know it's going to be later on this year and sometime after June.
The 425 is an infantry unit able to conduct airborne operations, but Pennell says the soldiers deployed will reflect a broader set of specialties.
They will take a variety of occupational specialties to include, obviously, infantry, but also support and field artillery and cavalry, and, you know, it'll be a slice kind of from across the brigade.
Pennell didn't yet know where in Afghanistan the soldiers will be based during their deployment. President Trump may soon issue an executive order intended to lift restrictions on oil development in Arctic waters. That's according to a Bloomberg News story. It cites three unnamed sources who say Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke spoke of it at an industry conference that was closed to reporters. The order would aim to reverse a decision by former President Barack Obama to indefinitely close most U.S. Arctic waters to leasing. Obama used a legal mechanism known as a 12A withdrawal. Environmentalists argue it can't be revoked, so a court challenge is likely. Meanwhile, Alaska's U.S. senators are also working to reopen Arctic waters to leasing. On Thursday, they jointly introduced a bill to repeal Obama's Arctic withdrawals and require new offshore lease sales. It's been a rough week for Alaska coal projects. Barely a week ago, the company behind the massive proposed Chewitna coal project near Cook Inlet announced it had halted permitting. Now, a federal judge has ruled against Usabelli Coal in a case involving the proposed Wishbone Hill mine east of Palmer. Judge Sharon Gleason ruled last summer that the mine's permit might not be valid and should be sent back to the Federal Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement, or OSM. Gleason said that federal law sets a deadline for mining activity to begin for a permit to remain valid, and Usabelli had not begun mining within that time frame. The OSM later determined that the Alaska Department of Natural Resources had been in error in renewing the permit. Usabelli Coal and the state of Alaska appealed that ruling, but yesterday Judge Gleason denied a procedural request required for the case to be sent to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Judge Gleason's decision places the future of Wishbone Hill, for now, back in the hands of federal regulators. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the state ramps up efforts to fight the opioid epidemic.
She ended up dying right in front of me. If I had the Narcan, I probably would have been able to save her.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Before the state Senate passed its budget on Thursday, Wasilla Republican Mike Dunleavy announced he's leaving the Senate majority. Dunleavy made the change in order to oppose the $4 billion spending plan supported by the rest of his caucus. He says he felt constrained in the majority, which requires members to support the budget.
I'm going to respectfully remove myself from the caucus in order for me to vote on this budget the way I think I need to, in order for me to vote on this budget that I think best represents my constituents.
Senate President Pete Kelly said today that the caucus hadn't decided how to respond to Dunleavy's departure. Leaving the majority generally means losing committee chair positions and funding for staff. For Dunleavy, that could mean losing his seat on the powerful Finance Committee and his chairmanship of the Senate State Affairs Committee. The change may make it more difficult for the Senate to vote to draw money from a state savings account. But Kelly added that Dunleavy would be treated as a friend. Dunleavy says the Senate should have cut the budget deeper and should not reduce Alaskans' permanent fund dividends. He denied that leaving the caucus lays the groundwork for him running for governor next year.
There's been people talking about, because the election's coming up, who is going to run for governor? And people have asked me if I'm going to run. I'm not committed to run for governor. I'm not going to dismiss it, but that's not what this is.
Meanwhile, if the state House doesn't agree to the Senate's budget changes, the two chambers will work out their differences in a conference committee. Funds for a roadside moose salvage program have dried up, and wildlife troopers are going back to a patchwork approach for getting roadkill meat to charities. A rule change means the Alaska Moose Federation can no longer use federal funding to respond to moose kills on the roads. Executive Director Don Dyer says emergency dispatchers will go back to using a phone list in order to find crews to salvage roadkilled moose meat for charities and families. He says the Federation was a quicker and more reliable strategy, having salvaged more than 1,000 moose in the last year and a half.
If you divide that all up into half-pound hamburgers, we supplied roughly about 450,000 hamburgers or moose burgers.
The moose meat will still make it to charities, but Dyer and others say the phone list method is more cumbersome than having one dedicated group. Dyer says, in the end, it's all about getting food to needy people.
You know, the people who are on the salvage list are a wide variety of people. I've delivered moose to airplane hangars, and I've delivered moose to people's apartments. That is what motivates our drivers to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and 30 below weather and keep doing this job, because it really does have a big impact on people's lives.
The Moose Federation hasn't changed its practice of picking up dead moose on private property. The group still accepts donations. This fall, more than 300 puffins washed up dead in the Pribilof Islands. What caused it? Starvation. At least that's the consensus among most scientists. But as Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, one ecologist thinks there may be another culprit.
Paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP. That's what Bruce Wright thinks killed these puffins and thousands of common murres in 2015. Wright is an ecologist with the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association, and he knows he's mostly on his own with this theory.
My colleagues are reluctant to say the things that I'm saying, because most scientists feel as if they have to have the rock-solid data in their hand to be able to draw these conclusions.
Even without hard facts, Wright feels comfortable saying PSP is involved because a professor trained him to approach science this way.
What your job is to make predictions based on your best judgment and the data you have. You're not going to be right all the time, but somebody's got to tell the managers that, look, this could be what's coming down the pike. We need to plan ahead.
Warmer oceans promote the growth of toxic algal blooms. As animals along the food web consume them, they can die. Big algal blooms were documented before both of these die-offs, and that's why Wright thinks PSP is a player. Because the toxins disappear quickly, he admits his hypothesis is more speculation than hard proof. Lauren Devine is co-director of St. Paul's Ecosystem Conservation Office. She agrees with Wright to a point. She says PSP could be a part of the picture, but not the whole picture. For her, the most important takeaway is that the puffins died of starvation.
Whether they missed a cue, or they were in the wrong place, or that they were in the right place and the food wasn't in the right place, is a total mystery.
At this point, Devine says bird carcasses have stopped washing ashore in the Pribilofs. While her team is still on the lookout for dead puffins, they're shifting gears to writing a paper on the die-off. Plus, they've refined their technical skills so they are better prepared to respond to the next event.
We know why it's important to collect those carcasses. We know how to actually necropsy on island and go through the steps of doing that preliminary determination of the cause of death ourselves.
Devine believes the big die-off has made other coastal communities more aware that they need to be looking for changes in their environment. For Bruce Wright, linking PSP to the die-off events is important because the toxins have the potential to transform ecosystems like the Aleutians. And he says PSP does not bode well for the health of the Bering Sea.
It's not to say that there won't be something out there to catch, but it might be something different than what we're catching now.
Recently tested samples from the Pribilofs showed the highest recorded PSP event happened last summer, before the puffin die-off. That alone, Wright says, should make people nervous about the future. Even though fishing in the Bering Sea is a multi-billion dollar industry, Wright says there isn't much money going into research that could help confirm or disprove his hypothesis. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
The state's Department of Health and Social Services is starting to distribute Narcan kits around Alaska. The nasal spray stops opioid overdoses. Alaska Public Media's Anne Hillman joined a group at the Covenant House in Anchorage as they assembled kits late last month.
20-year-old Nichelle Williams rips stickers off plastic pencil cases. Then she carefully lines up each box so the next volunteer can put on a different label.
They all have to be the same way.
No, not.
So it's easier to put the stickers on. You see they're putting stickers on them?
Mm-hmm.
So
she increases our chances not to screw it up.
Thank you.
They're at the beginning of a long assembly line for building Narcan kits, small plastic boxes that contain a nasal spray drug, basic instructions, gloves, and CPR masks. The kits will be used to stop overdoses from heroin, OxyContin, and other opioids. Williams jokes about the importance of her role, but she clearly understands the seriousness of what she's doing. Narcan saved her life twice. Her cousin wasn't as lucky.
She ended up dying right in front of me. If I had the Narcan, I probably would have been able to save her, but that wasn't, you know, it wasn't popular at that time.
That's why the state is trying to get Narcan into the hands of everyone who might need it. It's part of the governor's initiatives to fight the opioid epidemic. State epidemiologists report from 2009 to 2015, 774 people in Alaska died from opioid overdoses. Andy Jones is chief of emergency response for the state's Department of Health and Social Services.
This isn't about clinicians. This is about the general public. And what it means is we're giving a life-saving tool to everybody within who wants one within Alaska. And then they have the capability to be what they call a overdose rescue first responder.
He says administering Narcan to someone who is overdosing will buy time, but you still need to call 911.
It doesn't mean it's a home run for you. It usually means you have about 30 minutes to 40 minutes. Those opioids are still in your body and could bind back to your receptor and throw you back into an overdose.
Jones says some people have the misconception that giving away Narcan will make others more likely to use opioids. But he says that is not the case. Rapid withdrawal is a painful process. Nichelle Williams has firsthand experience with that.
When I overdosed and had to get Narcan, that was a worth withdrawal of my life, and I didn't want to go through that again.
She says having Narcan available did not make her think it was safer to use heroin or encourage her to use. But getting clean wasn't an easy process, and treatment options were not immediately available. Williams started using opioids when she was 17 after being prescribed narcotics for pain from foot surgery, and she quickly became dependent. When her pills ran out, she switched to heroin.
You know, when I experienced getting high, it took all my physical pain away. And then after the physical pain went away, it went to my head and was like a head and body high for me.
Williams says it helped ease her emotional pain, and she couldn't control her cravings. She overdosed 3 times, then was mandated to get treatment. She says the Narcan saved her life, but ultimately, she needed a strong support system to stay sober.
I think that, you know, like when you go and ask for help, not having people sit there and judge you and make you feel like you're less of a person because you use drugs, that's not okay to me.
Williams hasn't used in 6 months and plans to start her degree in psychology in the fall. Young people can request the kits from Covenant House staff to use themselves and to give to others. Anyone in the state who needs kits can email Project Hope at alaska.gov. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska, and by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, avalanche blasters. Most of Juneau's power is hydroelectric, and getting that power to the community requires transmission lines that traverse through miles of avalanche country. That's why Alaska Electric Light and Power Company hires helicopter crews to trigger slides and prevent destructive avalanches from knocking out their power. KTOO's Jacob Resnick went along for the ride to find out how it works.
Visibility 1-0.
A lot of AELP's power grid is miles from any road. Flying at about 4,000 feet in a chartered A-Star helicopter, avalanche forecaster Mike Janes gives the lay of the land. He points to high-tension power lines that traverse an area from Taku Inlet, southeast of town.
Backside there. And then the Snetisham line, this is the end of it right here, ends at the substation.
Extreme swings in temperature, blame it on climate change, have made the snowpack in the mountains less stable. That's kept avalanche control crews busy.
In the time that I've been doing this, we've had record snow years at Alpine and record low snow years in Alpine, all within a few years here. It's like that's kind of what's happened this year. We went dry and clear and cold for a while and formed a snowpack that you might see more commonly in Colorado, and now we're kind of going back into like the maritime, more snowfall, warmer temps regime, and those two don't mix very well together normally.
The bird's eye view has its limitations. The helicopter touches down near the summit of 3,300-foot Arthur Peak to drop off avalanche technician Kaden Bosler. He's running a simple test on the snowpack.
Basically, we cut out a block in the snow and try to see how the energy that we are putting on the snowpack by tapping on it with our shovel, how that transfers through the block. 14, ECT 14, propagation quality 1, sudden planar. Sudden collapse. Wow. This test definitely was a red flag for stability conditions with what we just saw here.
It's not long before Mike Janes returns in the helicopter. Dangling about 150 feet below is a device called a daisy bell. Fully loaded, it weighs about 1,000 pounds. The daisy bell creates a concussive blast by blending oxygen and hydrogen, then adding a spark that ignites the mix. It's like a man-made thunderclap.
You can see the little dust cloud down there. It's like, probably got something to move. Quite a nice explosion, pretty good punch to the snowpack.
Gone are the days of throwing explosives from the air. This is a cheaper and safer solution. Hovering at just 100 feet, Mike Janes and the pilot position the daisy bell just a few feet over snowpack that's layered into a natural cornice on the cliff's edge.
4, 3, 2.
There hasn't been much movement. Then the crew realized they triggered something big.
You can't see it, but we got probably 100 foot wide. Looks like it's down on that layer. I don't know which shot it happened on, but it pulled out like 20 feet below one of the shots we already made.
After 45 minutes of firing, the crew's work is done, for now. Bosler says modern avalanche control is often more methodic than dramatic.
Any day that we can come out and trigger some snow off the slope that isn't just stacking up there and waiting for a bigger slide to come, then we feel pretty good about that.
Juneau was cut off from hydropower for 45 days in 2008 after a slide knocked out transmission lines. AELP had to burn diesel to keep the lights on. It was as environmentally unfriendly as it was expensive for the company and ratepayers. After that experience, the utility invested millions into its avalanche control program. With the help of state grants, the company erected barriers to protect its most vulnerable transmission towers. avalanche crews will work through spring to keep nearly 60 miles of overhead transmission lines protected from slides. That should keep hydropower flowing to Juneau's households and businesses during even the snowiest months. For AK, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Shauna Rudio in Unalaska. Rudio is a high school English teacher at Unalaska City School.
Well, I actually ended up here because my now ex-husband got a job offer out here, so we came out here. I remember my mom telling me, you'll be there a year or two tops. And, you know, it was an adventure, and it was definitely, when I came to Unalaska, there was a real mystique about Dutch Harbor. So I was always really curious about it. I always knew that I wanted to come out here, and I'm really glad I did. I'm just closing in on my 18th year out here, 18th year of teaching out here. We lived in Helena, Montana for a while, and my dad would take me to the auction. I think it was like every Saturday. And I just was fascinated with what I saw, what I heard. And I was just looking at all that merchandise and just thinking, wow, some lucky person gets to go home with some of that stuff. The nice thing about living in Unalaska is that you, if you're somebody who likes to talk and is not afraid to speak publicly, you have a lot of people that are saying, hey, would you auction for us at our next fundraiser? And so I started doing that and just found out that I really enjoyed it. And there are a couple of other people here in town who do it, and I really enjoy working with them. I had the opportunity 2 summers ago to take an auctioneering class at the Western College of Auctioneering in Billings, Montana. Really not sleeping because I was running numbers up backwards and forwards, all kinds of tongue twisters. Betty bought her, bought some butter, but she said this butter's bitter. If I put it in my batter, it'll make my batter bitter. So she bought a bit of better butter, put it in her bitter batter, made her bitter batter better, so it's better, bit of better, bought a bit of better butter. Obviously, I'm out of practice there. I've always had very eclectic interests, and I definitely am a firm believer in, if you're interested in something, you should pursue it. You know, I yodel, so that's kind of goes into it a little bit. Just like anything that you can do to sort of mess around with your voice is fun. Let me see if I can get on a good run here.
Shauna Rudio lives in Unalaska. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Jacob Resnick, Zoe Sobel, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman, Zachariah Hughes, and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Rachel Waldholz. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.